Hi everyone, Christy here from Most One Thing. Today we have the honor to have Brad Stanfield as our guest in the podcast. Brad is a medical doctor in New Zealand, and beside his work in primary care, he has his own YouTube channel in which he shares the latest research and clinical guidelines on preventive medicine and longevity. I can highly recommend checking out his YouTube channel. In today's podcast, we're going to discuss his upcoming rapamycin trial and the importance of muscle when you get older, and lots of other interesting longevity topics. So, Brad, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's, I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, great. One good place to start this conversation is to look at your work in primary care. When you, for example, meet different patients, what common health problems do they face, and what can we learn from them?
Yeah, it's a variety. So I work in a semi-rural clinic. So I see, patients who are very financially well off and other patients who are quite poor. And so that's quite a nice variety, because you see patients who are generally quite well. And on the other spectrum, you see patients that have got, you know, terrible diabetes, terrible heart failure. So yeah, it's quite nice to have that. The differences there. So one of the things that we really try and do at the clinic is to optimize patients' health. And we do that by looking at them as a whole person. So we take a holistic approach. We don't just focus in on what the numbers tell us. So we want to know, you know, what's this patient doing in their life in terms of their diet, their exercise, their sleep, what's going on in the home, what stresses do they have, how's their mental health. Then we also look at the numbers. So what's their cholesterol? You know, what's their blood sugar levels? What can we do to prevent disease from happening in these people, and treat the existing disease that they've got? And one of the things that most patients will have in the clinic, because I often see older individuals, they've started to decline in their muscle performance and muscle function. And one of the big things that people lose is their independence. So they need to start, you know, having people to help them with their household duties. They can't cook and clean for themselves. They can't shower themselves. So that got me really interested in thinking, what can we do from a longevity standpoint to help people hold on to their muscle strength? Now, we know that exercise is brilliant. What we need is other interventions on top of exercise that will give us further performance benefits in terms of their muscle strength. So that's what got me quite interested in rapamycin, because, you know, in mice, we can see that rapamycin extends lifespan by about 10 to 20%. But because of how rapamycin works, if we pair it with exercise in the correct way, we might be able to help patients hold on to their muscle performance as they get a bit older. So that's what we want to trial.
And if we go a little bit back to the muscle loss part, when does it start to happen in people?
So, I mean, if you look at performance athletes, most of them will start to peak around the age of, you know, 25 to 30, and then slowly start to drop off. But I suppose in terms of clinical sarcopenia, in terms of, you know, when it really starts to affect patients, you know, looking after themselves and doing the hobbies that they want to do, it really starts to kick in from about 50 to 60. And then again, it really starts to drop away. So it's that drop that we're trying to prevent. Now, what seems to be apparent is that when we're younger, we want to try and maximize our muscle stores so that we've got a higher baseline. Because all of us will eventually have a general decline. But what we want to do is decline from a really high point. So it just means that we're carrying that muscle strength into our older years. And then again, we want to try and slow down that muscle decline as much as we possibly can, so that patients can, again, do the activities that they want to do and live a healthy, fulfilling life. So that's the goal.
And what basic things can people do to minimize muscle decline in life?
So I'd say that there's two big things. The first one is exercise, specifically resistance exercise. So we want to, so for example, patients going out for a walk is brilliant, right? But that's a starting point. We need to make sure that we're stressing the body in a safe way to stimulate it to build muscle. So one of the ideas around resistance exercise is progressive overload. So what that means is that you want to start, by lifting very light weight, so generally just body type exercises, and reaching a point where you're about 1 to 2 repetitions away from failure. So what I mean by that is you're doing a particular exercise, and you do as many as you can up until where you think you can no longer do one more, and then you back away just one or two from that, and that's 1 or 2 repetitions away from failure. And that signals to the body and signals to our muscles that they need to become stronger, that they need to hold on to their strength. So that's kind of the first thing is safe resistance exercise with progressive overload. The second thing is protein. So most patients don't get enough protein intake. So in a perfect world, we want patients to be having about 1.6 grams of protein intake per kilogram of body weight per day. So just to put that into some context, one egg has got about 6 to 8 grams in it, or a 100 gram steak, so beef steak, has got about 25 grams of protein. So you can see that for an 80 kilogram person who needs, 120 or 130 grams of protein every day, that is quite a lot of protein. That's a lot more than what most people get. And the reason why we want that high level is to make sure that we're getting as much benefit as we can from our resistance exercise. So the resistance exercise is the signal to our body that it needs to become stronger. Then we need to give it the raw materials to maximize the benefit from that signal. And as we get a bit older, our body also struggles to absorb protein. So for the patients that I see in the clinic who are above the age of 60, we're actually aiming for higher protein intakes, more around the 2 gram of protein intake per kilogram of body weight per day. So both of those things are really powerful. So again, resistance exercise and protein intake, to holding on to muscle strength. And most patients aren't doing that. So if you're doing both of them regularly, you're probably in the top at least 5% of the population. So that's a big starting point that I wish everyone would do.
Will that almost stop the muscle decline, or will the muscle decline also exist for those 5% of people?
It will still be present. So say a 70-year-old person is still not going to have the same strength as a 25-year-old person. But in terms of your functional capacity, looking after yourself at home, doing the hobbies that you want to do, going traveling or keeping up with the grandkids, that's very, very achievable just by doing resistance exercise and protein. And again, now we're looking at interventions to augment that, to see what can we do to help that 70-year-old person who's doing the exercise and the protein. What can we do in addition to that to help them have the strength of a 30-year-old?
If we look at the longevity camps, it's a little bit like there are two camps. One which advocate the low protein intake, and then there are other camp which advocate high protein intake. In some cases, it's quite hard to navigate in that area. What to believe when it sounds good on both camps. Why is it like that?
So there was a few mice studies that came out where that they tried a bunch of different diets in these mice, and they wanted to see what effect would these diets have on the mice lifespan. And what they found in some of the trials was that the mice who were fed a low protein diet and a high carbohydrate diet tended to live longer compared to the others. Now it's tricky to apply that into humans. Reason being is that these mice, they're housed in particular environments that they're generally disease-free. They've got all of the nutritional requirements that they need in terms of, their micronutrients and everything. That they're not hunted by predators. And so they don't need to be that strong because again, they've got everything provided for them. That's very different to the real world, where we're, you know, subjected to diseases, you know, such as even things like pneumonia. If people have got a higher muscle store, that they're more likely to survive that pneumonia or that lung infection and come out the other side. We also need to make sure again that we've got strength so that we can do the hobbies that we want to do. I think we just need to tread cautiously with trying to apply what we find in mice studies to humans. In particular, when we just look at the human studies, and admittedly these are observational studies, so just observing the population, that there's a clear trend that the populations that have a higher protein intake, particularly plant-based protein, they live longer compared to the, you know, other individuals that don't. Now, that comes with the caveat that this is just an observational study, but it is an interesting observation, and I think it does fit with the idea that we're trying to maximize our health span. And what I mean by that is the amount of years of life that we've got where we are disease-free, where again we've got the strength to do the activities and the hobbies that we want to do. So I think if we look at it through the lens of what can we do to maximize our health span, we want to have a high protein intake.
And why is plant-based protein better than animal protein when it comes to longevity? Does there exist any data on that?
So we can try and explain those findings. So the paper that I'm referring to was published in the British Medical Journal in 2020. Now there's a couple of possible reasons for this. Generally, plant-based protein sources such as, you know, chickpeas and lentils, they've got a high fiber content as well, and that fiber content will reduce, you know, cholesterol, specifically non-HDL cholesterol. So that's the type of cholesterol that's associated with, you know, heart disease. So that's one potential mechanism for it. And high fiber diets generally have other health benefits as well in terms of improving blood sugar levels and blood sugar control. So we can hypothesize about why plant-based protein diets appear to be better for human health compared to you know, other meat-based diets. But it's tricky. In these studies, there's always going to be a lot of confounding factors. So, for example, if someone is having a high meat diet, generally they're also eating, you know, lots of sugary foods, and that the protein sources that they're having is, you know, wrapped in a burger, with, you know, with that, that's not particularly great for you either. So, and lots of salt and things. So it is tricky to try and untangle that, because generally the people who have a high plant-based protein diet, that they're generally a bit more health conscious as well. So it's tricky to tease apart. What I would say though is that ideally we want to be focusing on lean protein sources. So I am an omnivore. I eat eggs, I eat beef from time to time, I eat fish, but the protein sources that I eat, I try and make sure they're lean. So if we're buying beef, we try and make sure that it's lean cuts of beef. If we're having chicken, we make sure to cut away any of the fat, you know, that those types of things. And I think most people would agree with that approach, that we want lean sources of protein.
Regarding the methionine restriction, does it have some connection also to this topic?
Yeah, possibly. So I think that again, that there's some mice studies that suggest that if you restrict a particular amino acid called methionine, that that's associated as well with longer lifespan. I'm not convinced that there's much human research to back that up. So again, it's speculation at this point. I think if we just focus in on, you know, trying to encourage patients to have lean sources of protein, be it plant-based or animal-based, as long as that is having some lean sources of protein, I think that's the main takeaway here. And then, you know, maybe with future research, we can untangle whether methionine restriction has got anything to do with it in terms of humans. But at this point, the general advice that I give to my patients is just to make sure that they are prioritizing protein for each meal.
And resistant training, as you said. Yeah, good. And this goes a little bit to the next thing you touched on about your rapamycin trial. And what made you interested in rapamycin and start a clinical trial in that area?
Yeah, so when I first started my YouTube channel, I wanted to figure out, what was the most likely strategy or molecules that we've got available to us to extend healthy human lifespan. So I looked at what the mice studies were showing, and from the interventions testing program, which is a fantastic program that tests different molecules in mice to see which ones can extend their lifespan, rapamycin overwhelmingly does it for both males and females, and it's been reproduced multiple times. So when they run the same experiments, they can see again and again and again, it does extend lifespan in these mice. The trouble is, there's not a lot of human research looking at rapamycin, because rapamycin in clinical medicine is used to somewhat help dampen down the immune system. So when patients have kidney transplants, for example, you want to make sure that your body doesn't reject that new kidney that you've just been given. So one of the drugs that you're given is rapamycin. So rapamycin's got a bit of a dirty name in clinical medicine, which is unfortunate, because I think that's the leading candidate for increasing healthy human lifespan. So I wanted to design a clinical study that looked at rapamycin to see, can it increase, healthy human lifespan? And with that, you need to be very careful about the endpoints that you're selecting. So, for example, if you design a rapamycin study where you're looking just at lifespan, you're going to be waiting decades for that study to come back. Ideally, you want to see more functional endpoints. So what I mean by that is, if you give rapamycin to people, will it improve their muscle performance? Will it, reduce rates of dementia? Will it improve their cognition? Will it reduce heart disease? Those are things that are very, very interesting, and we can get results far quicker compared to if we're just waiting for lifespan studies to come back. So when I was looking at how to design a functional clinical study, one of the interesting things that I stumbled across, and when I was looking at the research, so rapamycin, it blocks an enzyme called mTOR. So it switches mTOR off. Now, gym goers and people who want to build muscle, they want to switch mTOR on, because if you switch mTOR on, that stimulates protein synthesis and muscle building. So it seems a bit baffling, if we're trying to increase muscle performance, that we would want to switch mTOR off, because again, if you switch mTOR on, that's building muscle. But what seems to happen is that in older adults, the mTOR is, it's chronically switched on. It's almost like the body is trying to compensate for this declining muscle stores and muscle strength. So it's trying to build as much as it possibly can. The trouble with always switching mTOR on, though, is that you don't ever give the body a chance to go through a process called autophagy, or the cell clearance process. So we want to have periods of time where mTOR is switched off or downregulated, so that we can switch autophagy on. We want to clear away these old cell components so that then we can rebuild new ones. So what we think is that if we have periods of time where we're switching mTOR on via exercise, because that's one of the signals for switching mTOR on, paired with separate periods of time where we're switching mTOR off to allow, again, that cell clearance process to get rid of those old damaged components and then rebuild new ones, what we think that that balance will allow for greater muscle performance, particularly in older adults. So what we've done in our study is we want to see, will the combination of exercise and rapamycin offer greater muscle performance benefits compared to just exercise alone? So what we're doing is, we're taking older adults and we're exercising them 3 times a week. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then on the Saturday, then they take the rapamycin. And we're going to do that for 13 weeks. And what we're testing is, well, the primary outcome is the 30-second chair stand test. So how many times can you sit down and then stand back up in 30 seconds? Because that's a validated metric of muscle performance for older adults. So we want to see what the differences will be from the beginning of the trial to the end of the trial. And what we're first and foremost wanting to make sure about is that rapamycin doesn't block the positive effects of exercise. Because again, rapamycin switches mTOR off. So primarily, this will be a first safety study. That's why it's only got 40 people in it. Because once we prove that this idea is safe and ideally would see a signal towards benefit, that then gives us the justification to move to a larger phase three study. And so I'm excited about that pathway because if we do both of these studies, so again, the phase two study and then the phase three study, we will finally have a molecule that we can use and paired with exercise that will help older adults hold on to their muscle strength.
That will be a really great progress in the field. But as you said, if you're new to the topic, it feels a little bit strange. Like you said, that you need mTOR to build muscle, and rapamycin inhibits mTOR, and how can this get together in a good way? And yeah, super interesting trial there. Does there exist any animal studies that has looked at these things already, or is this totally new area?
So I'm not aware of a specific muscle performance exercise study in mice that combined rapamycin. There are a couple of studies in humans, and again, this is why we need the safety study, showing that if you give rapamycin immediately after or during a resistance exercise program, that does blunt the positive effects of exercise. So again, that's why we need the safety study, and that's why we've designed the study in such a way that you're taking rapamycin separately to the exercise that you're doing. So I think the field generally has accepted the hypothesis that we want to be only taking rapamycin once a week or once a fortnight. We probably don't want to be taking it every day. But again, we need the human studies to figure out if this is a viable strategy or not. We're extremely hopeful that it will be, but we need the study to be done to either prove or disprove it.
What dose protocol of rapamycin have you chosen to the trial?
So we've chosen 6 milligrams. Rapamycin has got a very long half-life. So it lasts in the body a very long time. So about sort of about four days in total. That's why we're only again that's another reason why to only give it once a week, and that's why we're giving the rapamycin on the Saturday as opposed to any other time during the week, because we want most of the rapamycin out of the system by the time that the patients start exercising again on Monday. So it will be it yeah it'll be an interesting avenue because if our hypothesis is proven correct, it might be that another formulation of rapamycin needs to be made where it's got a shorter half-life or it lasts in the body less, because it might just be that we need a short hit that only lasts maybe one day of switching mTOR off. But again, that's jumping ahead. We need the initial studies to be done first to prove or disprove whether this is a hypothesis that warrants all of the attention.
There is also another big trial ongoing, which is called the Pearl trial. What's the difference between the Pearl trial and your trial?
Yeah, so the Pearl trial is answering a separate question. They're answering the question of what happens if you just give rapamycin to individuals, and specifically what happens to their muscle mass and fat mass. So that will be a really interesting study because not everyone exercises. But it's not directly testing the hypothesis that we're trying to test in my study, which is again pairing exercise and rapamycin and having separate periods of time where you're switching mTOR on and off. So it's answering two very important questions, but they're different questions nonetheless.
What is the status of your clinical trial?
So we're all ready to go. We're just waiting on funding. So we've been trying to fundraise the study for about 18 months now. Now, clinical studies, they are very expensive to do. You need nurses, you need a data oversight committee to make sure that no serious side effects are happening. You need to make sure that you go through the appropriate ethics committees. You need to have a third party auditor because you can't just make stuff up in a clinical study. You need that third party oversight to again make sure that the data that you're producing is real. Then you need to write up the study. You need your statisticians. So in total, we need about $490,000 to run this 13-week study. And at the moment, we've raised about 130,000. So we've got a way to go yet. There's a couple of avenues that we've got. There's a couple of investors or philanthropists that we're talking with, or talking to. There's also a low dose multivitamin that I've recently launched, where I'm hoping that so that this multivitamin is to help people reach their recommended daily intakes of the different micronutrients without mega dosing. And we're hoping that will significantly help with the fundraising effort. So there's a couple of ways that we've got. We did try to, since I'm based in New Zealand, there's no grants really that I can apply for this particular type of research. So again, we're relying on other creative ways to try and reach that funding target. But once we reach that funding target, then we're good to go.
Is it also possible for private persons like me to support the clinical trial in some way?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've partnered up with a non-for-profit called lifespan.io. So they're providing a fundraising platform for us. So if you want to donate, there's a donation link on my website and all of the proceeds go through lifespan.io. So that's available for private citizens. And it's been fantastic actually. Just through private people, we've raised about, I think it was about 60,000, which is awesome from the community. Again, we've got a long way to go, but it's fantastic to see that people are actually wanting to put their hard-earned money towards important clinical studies like this.
And the longevity interest is just growing more and more every day here, so.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think has kind of gotten in the way of the longevity space or the so-called anti-aging space. You know, people for thousands of years have touted that they've got the latest anti-aging remedy or the fountain of youth. And I think people are tired of that they put their guard up because we've heard the story before. And I think what will really change the public's opinion is when we can actually show in clinical studies that yes, we can somewhat reverse, you know, muscle decline, we can prevent cancers, we can prevent heart disease. And a lot of the work that we're already doing in the clinic is doing that. We can prevent heart disease. We can prevent strokes. We've got fantastic screening programs to catch cancers early and treat them when they're very treatable. So there's a lot of things that people can do today to improve their health span and actually extend their lifespan. So that's primarily what I try and focus on my YouTube channel is what can people do today to do those things. And it's exciting to get the word out.
This goes a little bit to a curious question because there are so many health claims in different social medias. Different influencers say that take X or do you and you will get a great life or get more energy or increase your lifespan and things like that. How can people navigate in this environment in a good way, according to you?
Yeah, it's really, really difficult. There is so much information online, people saying one thing, people saying another, and it can be really confusing for the general public. What I would try and encourage people to do is that no matter what you hear online, including this conversation, just be skeptical. And try and come back to the clinical guidelines. So a lot of health influencers will become very famous because they are bashing the clinical guidelines, that they will say that the clinical guidelines are wrong. So one of the famous examples of this is cholesterol. There's a lot of people online who are very famous because they say you don't need to worry about cholesterol. Medical doctors are wrong. Really, you should be doing this and taking that supplement. And whenever you, but whenever you find a quite a famous health influencer, a lot of the time they've become famous because they've gone against the grain, that they've gone against the clinical suggestions and guidelines. And all of the since I've run my clinic, my YouTube channel, and really looked at the research and looked at why the clinical guidelines are written in such a way, it's really pleasing actually to see that the thought that's gone into the clinical guidelines and the clinical studies and the and if people just follow those clinical guidelines, that they will generally be far healthier compared to following what someone online has had to say. So yeah, that would be my suggestion. Just be skeptical. Focus in on the basics of diet, exercise, sleep, meditation, life purpose, socializing. And if you really, really did want to look at supplements, creatine is not a bad shout. It does seem to improve muscle performance. Omega-3 is not a bad shout either. There's some research to suggest that it lowers heart disease risk. And taking a low dose multivitamin, again, it's not a bad shout. Just make sure that the multivitamin that you take is not mega dosing. And again, that's why I designed my multivitamin, because I couldn't find one that I personally wanted to take. So yeah, overall, just be extremely skeptical with what you hear online.
One thing I know that you have also talked about earlier is the evidence pyramid. Can you explain what that is, and can that be used for example, evaluating studies and data or claims?
Yeah, so the evidence pyramid is how different evidence is ranked. So, for example, if someone says to you, "I tried this diet and I feel amazing," that evidence is one case study. But if you compare that to, say, a massive randomized controlled study that compares two different diets, and one diet is clearly better than the other in that well-conducted study, that's going to be a higher level of evidence compared to what that one person said about their individual experience. So that's what the evidence pyramid is. So right at the bottom, you've got your case. Right at the bottom, you've got your opinions. And this includes expert opinions. That's right at the bottom. Then you've got your case studies. And then your observational studies, so just observing a population and seeing what possible insights you can glean. Then you've got your randomized controlled trials, so where one group is doing one particular thing and another group is doing another, and you're comparing both groups to see which one has a better health outcome. Then the next step on the ladder is combining those randomized clinical studies. So that's called a meta-analysis, where you're combining all of those relevant clinical studies together. You're trying to evaluate their quality, so their different biases and how those studies have been run, and hopefully coming up with a conclusion. Now, the best organization that run these meta-analyses is called Cochrane. So if you watch my channel, you'll often see me referring to what the latest Cochrane review has to say, because of the rigorous methodology that the Cochrane organization uses to combine the individual randomized controlled trials. Their analysis is reproducible, and again, it's very methodical, and you can come up with a conclusion. So that's the evidence pyramid. So if people are trying to interpret what they should be doing for their own health, try and look at what Cochrane has had to say about a particular topic, and try and look at what the clinical guidelines have had to say. That's right at the top of the evidence pyramid, and then everything falls down underneath that.
You mentioned the randomized control trials. Why is it important to do randomized control trials with a placebo arm? Can you explain what the benefits are with that?
Yeah, so say if a population, or say a group of people are told that if you take this pill, you're going to start lifting more weights at the gym, and you're going to start improving your energy levels, and you're going to get a promotion at your job, and it does this because of these amazing effects that it has on your cells. So if you tell a population that, they will generally believe it. And this is called the placebo effect, where they think that a particular intervention or a pill is helping them, and then it does help them. That's the placebo effect. Now, it's really important to know whether an intervention is just because, or the benefits of an intervention is just because of the placebo effect, or if there's a true benefit. So that's why we run these randomized controlled trials. So you've got generally one group who's taking the placebo or the dummy medication, and another group who's taking the real medication or drug. But the people within those groups, they don't know which group they're in. So they don't know if they're taking the placebo or the real drug. And that way you can truly see if there's a positive effect or not. So that's why we run those clinical trials. And it tries to control for things like the placebo effect, and it tries to minimize the other, what we term confounding factors within the trials. So that, yeah, that's why we do it.
Do you have any example of a great placebo effect that how it works in a study?
So, for example, a lot of people take green tea extract to say that, you know, it's going to calm their mood and whatnot. But in the clinical studies, when they compare it to a placebo, there's no difference. So that's a classic one where we can, that's why we don't prescribe green tea extract, because when it's tested in the randomized controlled trials, there's no benefit seen. So that's a classic example.
I heard also some study, I think they looked at the knee surgery or something like that. Do you know something about that study?
Yeah, so these are sham procedures. So I think they were looking at repair of the meniscus in the knee, a particular repair procedure. And they weren't actually sure going into the study if this repair or the surgery was actually beneficial for patients, or compared to just, you know, giving them under the guidance of a physio doing some strength training. So what they did is quite a clever study. They so patients knew going into the study that it was a study, and it was a sham procedure. So the patients were put to sleep, and then the surgeon made a cut into their knee, and the surgeon then opened up an envelope to say, Do you need to do this procedure, or do you just need to sew the cut back up? So the patient didn't know whether they actually had the surgery or not, because again, they've just got a cut that they don't know what's going on inside their knee. And they followed these patients up over a few months, and they wanted to see, was there actually an improvement in their knee function with this surgery or not? And there was no difference. So what that told us was that this surgery that was done, there was no point in doing it. If anything, it was harmful, because it was expensive. It introduces the chances of infection, of bleeding. So that procedure is now no longer done. So that's a classic point where randomized controlled trials absolutely need to be done to minimize any, you know, so-called placebo effect.
And your trial, is it a randomized controlled trial also, or?
That's right. So both groups will be exercising, but one group will be taking rapamycin on the Saturday, and another group will be taking the placebo on the Saturday. And again, the individuals in the study, they don't know which group they're in, so they're blinded. And it's the same thing with the people who will actually be running the trial. They won't know who's in which group and what medication they're actually giving, because it's the medication that will be used in our study, the placebo looks exactly the same to the rapamycin. So again, it's a double blinded randomized controlled trial that's placebo controlled.
Yeah, it's it can be complicated terms here, but as you said, this is quite important things to have knowledge about. It helps people to navigate in this jungle.
Yeah, because as you said before, it can be very difficult to figure out how should you be healthy. And that's one of the reasons why I started my channel. You know, so many patients or so many people online, that they're researching things because they want to be healthy. And most of the information that you hear online, unfortunately, is based on cell data or mice data, not actually the human data. And even the health influencers that try and focus on the human data, they often they don't evaluate things through the lens of the evidence pyramid. So they'll take case studies, they'll take poorly conducted clinical trials and say, oh, well, people should be doing this because this peer-reviewed study said so, and it's in humans, when that's not correct. We should be looking at this through the lens of the evidence pyramid and looking at what the Cochrane reviews have to say and what the clinical studies, sorry, what the clinical guidelines have to say.
And you touch a little bit on supplements like creatine and omega-3. Is it the supplements that you take also?
Yeah, so there's a list of supplements that I take. But I want to caveat this by saying none of this is a replacement for diet, exercise, sleep, meditation, socializing, blood pressure control, cholesterol control. Everyone should be focusing on that first before even considering supplements. So I just want to get that caveat out of the way. But some of the supplements that I use is creatine, 5 grams a day. That's based on truckloads of human clinical randomized controlled studies that show that people who take creatine, that they can lift heavier weights, they recover from their exercise a bit quicker, they've got reduced rates of injury. There's also some interesting research to suggest that it may actually improve cognitive performance. Now that's still debated because the meta-analysis that was done, the actual clinical studies weren't that brilliant. So we need to take that with a grain of salt. But there certainly doesn't seem to be really any downside for taking creatine. We've got safety trials going out 5 years showing that overwhelmingly, yes, creatine is safe. Some people get some gastrointestinal discomfort, things like diarrhea, but that's a minority of patients. There was also a concern that it would damage kidneys, but that's been disproven. So yeah, it's the there are benefits that we can get from creatine, and it does appear to be very safe. So that's the first supplement that I suggest to patients if they do want to go down the supplement route. Other supplements people that can consider, yeah, things like omega-3. Omega-3, so there was a massive study called the VITAL trial. That took thousands of patients, and it gave some of them omega-3 and other patients the placebo. And in the group that were taking the omega-3, they had lower rates of heart attacks in that study. Now that needs to be with the caveat that high dosages of omega-3 are associated with a particular heart arrhythmia called atrial fibrillation. Yeah, there are risks of taking too much omega-3. So I take 1 to 2 capsules of omega-3 a day. And I make sure to take a brand that's third party tested. So I take a brand called Uno Cardio, which has been third party tested. And so you know that that's you're taking the omega-3 that's listed on the label. There's another supplement that I take called hyaluronic acid. And again, this is based on human randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials that show that people who took the hyaluronic acid, they had less skin wrinkles and improved hydration of their skin. So if it's helping your skin, is it helping other organs in your body? So we don't know the answer to that yet, but if it's going to help your skin, why not take it? So in the same vein, I also take collagen peptides as well. There is a bit of a debate. So collagen peptides are made up of short chains of amino acids. So there is a bit of a debate at the moment as to whether you would get the same benefits from collagen peptides as you do just from taking protein. There is one study, however, in burn patients that gave equal amounts of protein, and it compared it to equal amounts of collagen peptides. And the collagen peptide group, their burns healed quicker. So that they're Based on that study, that's the reason why I take collagen peptides in addition to the protein that I take in my diet. Then again, it's not a bad option to take a low dose multivitamin, and I do want to stress a low dose because a lot of the multivitamins that are available today, they mega dose things. So For example, the recommended daily intake of vitamin C is 90 milligrams, but you'll see that most multivitamins take, orders of magnitude higher than that, 500 milligrams, 1 gram. That I think that's a bad idea. So if we just take vitamin C quickly as a segue, there's good reason to believe that if you take high dosages of antioxidant vitamins, such as vitamin C, you blunt the positive effects of exercise. So when you exercise, you are stressing your body. You release all sorts of oxidants, and that's a good thing. That signals to your body that it needs to become more efficient. But if you're taking high dosages of antioxidant supplements, such as vitamin C, you blunt that oxidative stress. Therefore, you blunt the signal to your body. Therefore, you blunt the positive effects of exercise. And there's been multiple studies showing that now. So, yes, we definitely want to have vitamin C, but we don't want to be mega dosing it. And again, that's why I created my own low dose multivitamin and multimineral to address that.
Is it also that you should not take, for example, antioxidants after you have exercise? It's better to take it another day or
Yeah, so I don't take a particular antioxidant anymore. I used to based on one of the trial what sorry one of the studies that came out from the interventions testing program. Again, that's that mice lab, well, not the mice lab, but the mice studies. There was a antioxidant mixture called Protandim that was associated with longer lifespan. But again, I'm hesitant because we don't have much human research to support the idea that we want to be loading our body with antioxidants.
And what other supplements do you take?
Yeah, I take melatonin at night, but a very, very low dose. So, the dose that I take is 300 micrograms, whereas you can find it on the shelf for 10 milligrams, which is order of magnitudes higher. The reason why I take the low dose, I've always kind of struggled a bit with sleep, and I find that the very low dose melatonin just gives me that kick to fall asleep. But other people who have got no issues with their sleep, that they certainly wouldn't need to take melatonin. But that's it. So it's a relatively short list of supplements that I take. So, it's creatine, omega-3, a low dose multivitamin and multimineral, the collagen peptides, the hyaluronic acid, and then that low dose melatonin. So it's other people are taking lists and lists of supplements, but when you look at the research, particularly the human research through the lens of the evidence pyramid, that there's no clear benefit to most of the supplements that you'll see on the market today.
One thing that recently has come up in the social media feeds a lot is the compound taurine and longevity. I don't know if you have seen it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm halfway through reading the paper at the moment. I'm actually hoping to shoot a video later on today about it. Taurine has it's in a lot of different energy drinks. When I first looked at the research on taurine, it looked quite interesting to me. That this is a couple of years ago, so I made a conscious decision that the magnesium supplement that I take is paired with taurine. So you'll often see that. That because magnesium needs to be with something, so it magnesium citrate or magnesium threonate. So the magnesium that I chose was magnesium taurate, so it's got the taurine in it. So I've been taking magnesium taurate for about 3 years now, so it's kind of fortuitous that I was already taking taurine. But yeah, I think that this study is interesting because it looked at multiple organisms. It looked at worms, it looked at mice, it also looked at monkeys to see if there were if they could see improvements in the markers of aging there, and they could. So I don't want to get too carried away because again, this is not in humans. But it is quite exciting. So hopefully, well-conducted human studies can be done to see whether this is something that people should be taking or not.
And there is also one other thing you touched a little bit about, that the supplements can vary in quality and purity. How can people navigate there in a good way?
Yeah, so ideally you want to have a supplement that is third-party tested. So there are certain websites that do it. So labdoor.com is one of them. Consumerlab.com is another. So that's one way of doing it. Another way is to look at where the supplement was manufactured, whether those facilities were FDA approved, whether they meet certain testing and certification requirements, because the supplement industry is rife with, you know, mislabeling, with products not actually containing the ingredients that are listed on the supplement bottle. So it is important that people try and, again, take a supplement that is third party tested and got the appropriate that are produced in appropriate facilities.
We have talked about supplements, and if we go to medical drugs, do you take rapamycin?
No, I don't. I think the mice studies are interesting, and I want human clinical studies to be done, but we don't have those clinical studies yet. So I don't want to base my own health decisions or my patients' decisions on what my studies show. I'm very excited about rapamycin. I don't want people to get the wrong idea, but no, I don't take it because we don't have the human studies yet.
And if we look at the data there, what type of data do you want to see when it comes to rapamycin before you take it?
So I want to see randomized controlled trials, first of all, showing that this therapy is safe in otherwise healthy people. And I want to make sure that there is clear benefit. So that's why we've designed, say, my study in such a way so that to look at the 30-second chair stand test to see, does rapamycin in combination with exercise actually improve muscle performance compared to just exercise alone? Randomized controlled trials with firm endpoints need to be done before I'd want to take it, in my view. Other people are a bit more gung-ho and just base their decisions on what the mice studies show. I think they can be a bit dangerous, though. For example, you know, metformin, people were very excited about taking metformin for non-diabetics because there were some initial mice studies to suggest that it extended lifespan. What we found, though, is that metformin for non-diabetics lowered testosterone levels. It blunted the positive effects of exercise. So overall, it probably made people's health worse. So that's a classic example for why I'm hesitant about just basing health decisions on what my studies show. We need the human clinical research.
Is it something special you're concerned about when it comes to rapamycin?
So rapamycin, again, it switches off mTOR. So there is the possibility that even if we're just taking rapamycin once a week, that we could be worsening muscle performance. There is that possibility. I don't think that is the case, but it's still a possibility that needs to be tested. So that's one of them. Another possible concern is immunosuppression. I'm not that concerned about that because a separate large study was done looking at the response to the influenza vaccine. So they took patients, they gave them the influenza vaccine, and half of them had the placebo, other half a molecule that blocked mTOR. And what they found is that there was actually a trend towards improved response to the influenza vaccine in the rapamycin group. And the theory goes is that, again, if you clear away the old components in the body and then they're refreshed with new ones, then you've got a better immune system that's more adept at fighting off infection. So I'm not that concerned about the immunosuppression side of things. My study is primarily looking at what happens with muscle.
And it's a little bit the metformin effect there, which you want to see that it doesn't blunt muscle performance.
Yeah, that's right. Again, I think if people use rapamycin on the days that they don't exercise, I think that it will overall improve muscle performance, but that's a hypothesis that needs testing.
It can be good to define also what the blunt of muscle performance mean. It doesn't mean that it has a negative effect. If I understand it correctly with the metformin, it's just that the effect of exercise is not as high as without metformin. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. In the study that I'm referring to, I think it was published in 2019, they looked at what one of the measures was VO2 max. And the group that were taking the metformin, they only had half of the improvement in their VO2 max compared to the group that weren't taking metformin. Now, VO2 max is a marker, a very important marker for what it correlates very well with longevity. So generally, people with a higher VO2 max will live longer and have less disease. So if a molecule is blunting the VO2 max increases, that's not a great signal. So again, so yes, it didn't cause harm, as in it didn't cause the VO2 max to go down, but equally, you certainly don't want to be blunting the positive effects of exercise either. You want to be finding molecules that improve the effects of exercise.
If we go back to rapamycin here, what the weak points do you see around rapamycin that we need more research on?
I think the biggest one, and again, sorry, I'm biased, but the reason why I designed my trial was muscle performance. We don't know what will happen if we give rapamycin intermittently on days that we don't exercise. I think that's a glaring weak point, because if as people get a bit older, that's when they start to become really interested in longevity in particular. And so many older people that I've spoken with in the industry are taking rapamycin. It would be a travesty if rapamycin was actually worsening muscle performance. Once again, I don't think it will. I think overall it will improve muscle performance, but we don't have the clinical research yet. That's what we need to either confirm the hypothesis that we want to have separate periods of time where we're switching mTOR off via rapamycin. So that to me is the biggest glaring weak point in our understanding of rapamycin in humans at this stage.
And how well do you think that the animal data on rapamycin will be translated to humans? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's hard to say. What I would say is that the reason why I'm so excited about rapamycin's potential in humans is how robust the mice studies are. So over and over again, when it's tested in mice, it extends lifespan in both males and females. Now that there's a question mark again about what rapamycin does to health span, as in what it does to muscle performance. So I'm hopeful that it will translate to humans, but once again, I sorry to sound like a broken record. We need the studies. We need the studies done.
And if we look at other longevity interventions, what three longevity interventions would you say are the most promising for humans?
What free interventions?
Yeah, three. Yeah, you can take four or five if you
Oh,
want.
right, three. Okay. Honestly, diet, exercise, and sleep. Overwhelmingly, that's the theme. So it's very exciting to talk about rapamycin and what's going on in the labs, but as of right now, diet, exercise, and sleep, absolutely we need to focus on. And so with diet, it's making sure again that we're getting enough protein, that we're reducing saturated fat intake and reducing salt, and reducing sugars. So you replace it with generally high fiber foods and protein. With exercise, we want to have resistance exercise as well as cardio. And sleep, we just want to make sure that we're getting enough of it and that it's high quality. So, for example, making sure you don't suffer from sleep apnea, making sure that you're not getting woken up by, by your pets, those sorts of things. But then if you're looking at things on top of that, which I think is more the question that you're asking, I would say people generally, their cholesterol levels are too high. And so even if you get a normal cholesterol blood panel result back, it's still not optimal. So if you look at your LDL cholesterol, in a perfect world, you probably want that below 60 or 70. And most patients are nowhere near that. So normal would be sort of below 100 or 120, which in my opinion is still too high. Like you want that quite low. You want to stop any blockages from occurring in your blood vessels. It's the same thing with blood pressure. A lot of people, their blood pressure is around, 140, 145, and that's just too high. You want that below 130 generally. So I think people need to focus in on those things, as well as the well-established cancer screening programs. We want to be screening for skin cancer. We want to be up to date with the mammograms, with cervical smears, with bowel cancer screening, with prostate cancer screening, lung cancer screening. We've got validated screening methods that the American Cancer Association or Society has published that everyone should be doing. So those are the fundamentals of health that everyone again should be doing. And then you can start to think about your creatines and your omega-3s and your hyaluronic acids and those sorts of things. The supplements are a very, very small part compared to that baseline of health that people should be doing.
And what longevity interventions do you practice?
It's all the things that I just went through. So again, diet, exercise, sleep, meditation, socializing, life purpose, the cancer screening programs. I take a low dose statin, so rosuvastatin, 5 milligrams to, so even with all that I was doing with diet and exercise, my LDL cholesterol was still around, I think it was 75, and I wanted it below 60, so I started taking a statin. I also take a low dose finasteride. Reason being is that there's a lot of, well, there was a massive study looking at prostate cancer rates, and admittedly this was using a higher dose of finasteride, so 5 milligrams, but it showed about a 20% reduction in the chance of developing prostate cancer. So I take 1 milligram of finasteride since I'm, only 31, to try and reduce my chance of developing prostate cancer in the future. So those are the two drugs that I take. So it's the statin and the finasteride.
Do you practice time-restricted feeding or fasting or something like that?
So I make sure that I try and have an early dinner, and don't eat after that. But aside from that, no. If you try and eat within a smaller window in the day, that's suboptimal in terms of muscle building and your protein intake. Ideally, you want to have protein meals spaced about 4 hours apart. You want hits of protein because that hit stimulates to your body again to build muscle. So if you're only eating within an 8 hour window in the day or a 4 hour window in the day, it's not optimal for that. Also, generally people use intermittent fasting as an excuse to skip breakfast, which is the last thing that you want to do. And they also use it as an excuse to eat late at night. So classically, people will eat between 12 p.m. and 8 p.m. and that's terrible for your blood sugar level control, for your insulin levels. So no, I don't, outside of having an early dinner and not eating after that dinner, I don't practice any other form of intermittent fasting.
We have some rapid questions from the listeners. One thing that they wondering about is that when you combine different longevity interventions together with each other, that's quite a tricky area, because in some cases interventions can cancel the effects from each other and or even lead to detrimental effects. How can people navigate in that area in a good way?
I suppose it depends on people's worldview. So again, some people focus on what the interventions testing program results will show. And if the interventions testing program seems to suggest that a particular molecule extends life, then they will start taking it. Again, that's not the approach that I would take, because it's mice data. We're not mice. We don't live in a lab. We live in the real world. So yeah, it's a tricky one. Because again, the interventions testing program, outside of testing combinations such as rapamycin and metformin, we don't know what the what it, combining these interventions will do. So, I generally, personally, would avoid combining so-called longevity interventions because there's just such a lack of research that you could be doing far more harm than good. If you notice through the supplements that I take. None of them are particularly groundbreaking, right? Like creatine, we've known about for decades, low-dose multivitamin, collagen, hyaluronic acid, you know, none of it's, yeah, n n none of it's, how would I say, game-changing in terms of, you know, turning a 90-year-old into a 40-year-old. And that's because we don't have the research yet. We don't have the technology yet. So my worldview is that we should wait. Because there's a huge risk of possible harm for combining these interventions. Other people say, I'm going to take the risk, and that's completely up to them.
And then we have the question about mTOR. How can people find the sweet spot for optimal mTOR activation for longevity? Because many different longevity intervention inhibits mTOR. But how can people know, for example, that they push things too much or too little?
This is one of the big questions that we don't know the answer yet to about trying to strike a balance. And that's one of the reasons why we're trying to run my clinical trial to try and help elucidate that balance. What I probably would say though is that I think for the general population at this stage, we focus too much on that. I think we just need to focus in on the basics of making sure we're doing resistance exercise, we're doing some cardio exercise, and that we're getting enough protein. Outside of those things, we don't know, we don't know enough. And that's why we need the clinical studies. So I wouldn't waste any thought or sleep over trying to balance mTOR. What I would just say is, again, just wind it back to the basics: diet, exercise, and sleep.
Because there are no biomarkers which you can look on to guide.
I would be, I'd just worry about that. The biomarkers will change drastically. So for example, if you have a workout and then you take a biomarker of your mTOR activation, it will be very different compared to if you haven't exercised for a week. It's the same thing with protein intake. So and we don't know what the optimal levels of those biomarkers are, and if they've got much correlation at all with human health. So I just tread cautiously. If you want to spend your money on anything, you know, spend it on a gym membership, spend it on you know, cholesterol lowering medications if that's what's needed. Spend it on, you know, seeing your doctor regularly for just health checkups. Those are the types of things that I would encourage patients to do rather than worrying about particular biomarkers of mTOR.
And what's your view on, for example, DEXA scan or things to look how much muscle you have?
It depends on what motivates you, I suppose. So in clinical medicine, we use DEXA scans to look at bone density, to see if a patient's got osteoporosis or not, and whether we need to do something in terms of medications as well as lifestyle to strengthen up their patients' bones. If people are using it just to measure their muscle mass and fat mass, again, it's if people want to use that as motivation, fine. But in my view, it doesn't change anything. If you've got, low, if you've got low fat mass and a great muscle mass on your DEXA scan, I'd certainly wouldn't want people to say, oh, well, that's great. I don't need to exercise as much, or I don't need to, worry about my diet as much. I still want people to focus on the diet and exercise. So in my view, those scans don't change anything. People should still be doing diet and exercise and sleep, regardless of what the scan shows. So I don't recommend them because I don't see the value add. Again, if people want to use it for further motivation to say, my baseline muscle mass was here and now it's here because I started exercising, great. But outside of that, I don't see the utility of it.
And if you were 90 years old today, Brad, how would your longevity interventions differ from what you're doing today?
I don't think, to be honest, they would. I think I would be doing the exact same of what I'm doing today, with the exception that if I was really gung-ho, I might consider adding in NAC. So since I take collagen peptides have got a lot of an amino acid called glycine in them. And glycine paired with NAC seems to support an antioxidant in the body called glutathione. And glutathione seems to really drop from about the age of 45. So if I was 90, I'd possibly, in addition to what I'm doing already, I'd consider taking NAC. But the research on supporting glutathione levels is still at its infancy. So yeah, it would, I suppose, depend on how gung-ho I felt on the day. But overall, there'd be no change from what I'm doing as of right now. I think it's very easy to complicate a longevity stack, but diet, exercise, sleep, and the occasional supplement at the moment is the way to go until further research is done.
And the last question here, how do you keep up to date with the latest longevity research in the field?
So I primarily look at the clinical guidelines. So the clinical guideline database that I use in my medical practice is called uptodate.com. And within that, they have a what's new section. So new studies are sent to me from that virtually every day. There's also another database in New Zealand that has a very similar feature. Then I also follow particular researchers and medical doctors on Twitter. So Twitter is actually a fantastic resource to keep up with the latest. So a couple of people that are worth following in my view, Nutrition Made Simple. So Gil is the author there, and he's fantastic. Other people, there are certain lipidologists that I follow. I'm just trying to remember. So Dr. Lipid is fantastic for cholesterol advice, and he'll often respond to your questions as well. People like Matt Kaeberlein are fantastic. But outside of, yeah, people like Charles Brenner as well, that he offers quite a grounded view. So that's how I generally try to do it. But mostly I focus in on what the clinical guideline databases tell me.
Is that database open for the public, or is it only for physicians?
Yeah, I to be honest, I think it costs about $500 a year. So it's not open access, unfortunately. But people like, yeah, Nutrition Made Simple are very good at reporting on the latest clinical trials that actually make a difference to human health. In particular, looking at cholesterol levels and blood pressure and things like that. Peter Attia is also a good follow as well.
And where can people find you online, Brad?
Yeah, so I've got a website, so it's drstanfield.com. I've also got a YouTube channel called Dr. Brad Stanfield, and on Twitter as well. Again, Dr. Brad Stanfield, and you'll be able to find me. So yeah, those are the three places that people can best find me. And I try and produce a YouTube video about once a week with a piece of research that I've come across that I find interesting. So, yeah.
Great. And as I said in the beginning, I can highly recommend Brad's YouTube channel. There are lots of good stuff there. And you have a good way of explaining complex things in a easy way, which is really great.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. And thanks very much for having me on your show. It was a fun conversation.
Yeah. Thank you. Take care now.
Bye.
Bye. Disclaimer: the podcast is for general information and educational purposes only, and is not medical advice for you or others. The use of information and other things linked to the podcast is at the user's own risk. Always consult your physician with anything you do regarding your health or medical conditions.